KALW.
People play sports, and that's some form of rehabilitation for them. It's not like no regular self-help class.
Athletes at San Quentin play everything from basketball to pickleball.
It's a place where people go and they join some type of bonded brotherhood.
We'll meet the man who covers it all for the prison paper. Then Berkeley drummer James Stick Nasty Small talks about his debut solo album.
You can use music to express your love for someone and your love for yourself.
And we'll hear why a seminal Jewish text got an updated translation.
So the Zohar is probably one of the most magical and intricate books in the Jewish bookshelf.
A project 2 decades in the making. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today we begin with a story from Uncuffed. San Quentin State Prison has one of the most robust sports programs in California prisons. There's a 70-year-old baseball team, hardcore marathon runners, a basketball team that often gets visitors from the Golden State Warriors. Recently, people even started playing pickleball. And the job of the sports editor at the San Quentin newspaper is to document it all. Uncuffed producer Ryan Pagan interviewed San Quentin News sports editor Tim Hicks on what it's like to report courtside.
I'm Timothy Hicks. I'm from East Oakland, California. I'm a sports editor now for San Quentin News. I started off in the Journalism Guild as a journalism writer.
You know, you're a very talented person, man.
No, thank you, man.
You know, I've known you, I think, about a year now. Did you think that you would be a sports editor?
Never. I never thought that I would be a sports editor. Never thought that I would be writing on this professional level that I am now, working with the newspaper. Never thought it in a million years till I came to San Quentin. And I started covering baseball games, and I went from baseball to basketball to soccer to tennis to all of the other sports that they had here. You know, I fell in love with it. When I was younger, I wanted to be a football player. I was playing for Pop Warner football when I was young, and I was good at it too. I was a running back. You know, I run up the field, you know, and be enjoying the sprint and enjoying just hitting with the little baby pad. My leg got injured when I was young, and it derailed my path.
I also played Pop Warner growing up. I played high school football. I love it. I love football. I love sports. Fast forward now, you get to talk about sports. You get to see the talented individuals that are here at San Quentin State Prison.
I found by writing through sports, people play sports, and that's some form of rehabilitation for them. It's not like no regular self-help class. It's a place where people go and they join some type of bonded brotherhood.
Has there been any articles that you've written where someone approached you and said, "Hey, I don't like what you wrote. I didn't like what you said"?
Although I wrote a lot of articles that received a lot of praises, there has also been articles I wrote. Some guys had something to say that wasn't so much of a praise. You know, it could be something as small as didn't spell their name right, or didn't get the quote right. Or
so you don't ever write about guys getting dunked on, right, on the basketball court? Like, man, so-and-so got dunked on. Because I would be pissed if someone wrote that about me. Like, man, why you write it like that? But you got to report the truth. So has there been any article where you really, like, had to just, like, lay down the facts, man, that someone just didn't appreciate?
I could think of articles are times where I really wanted to write some quotes or expressions of guys who really got dunked on really hard, or scored a touchdown on, or really got showed out on the court or field, you know. But I try not to embarrass guys in my articles. I try not to make guys feel belittled or ashamed. I never try to make them feel feel funny, you know.
Clean journalism.
Clean journalism.
Nice, clean journalism. Not trying to make anyone feel a certain way. And plus, you can't, right? Because at the end of the day, we're locked up, right? So we got to be careful still. There is differences between this organization and an organization that's out there in the free world. We are working on ourselves as incarcerated men. A lot of us have unresolved issues and problems that we're working through. And in the process of rehabilitation, we are dealing with real world problems in the office setting.
Some of the things that I learned down here from working with individuals with different attitudes, different temperament, different types of people. I learned anger management for one, tolerance and patience, and I learned all types of other skills that I'm going to have to use to adapt to the outside world once I get there. What separates being in prison and working for a company from the outside world is that you can't go nowhere. You know, you're here and you have to deal with this. You have to face it versus being on the outside. You could just walk away from the place, you know, and don't never go back again. But being in prison, you can't just walk away and don't come back.
You know, working down here, I mean, you've seen many people come and go, right? You've seen lifers leave and then come back and volunteer. Like, is that something you see yourself doing in the future once you get released?
That has been so inspiring to me to see guys get out from working here side by side with me in the newsroom.
And not come back locked up.
Yeah. As an incarcerated person, you know, and then they coming back voluntarily and continuing our mission. So I'm looking forward to being one of those guys who also get out and then bring that help guys that's incarcerated inside the newsroom still and help them get out or help them with whatever they need, you know, to continue the mission of the newspaper, you know.
And why do you want to do that? Like, you know, I mean, who cares about the guys in here, right?
It lets me see that I too can be one of those people, parole, come back and give back to the place that helped it all happen.
That was San Quentin sports editor Tim Hicks speaking with Ryan Pagan, a producer in the Uncuffed program at San Quentin. Our work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. You can hear more by subscribing to Uncuffed on your podcast player. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. If you're a fan of Fantastic Negrito, then you've heard his drummer, James Sticknasty Small. And you may have seen him, too. James starred in Fantastic Negrito's film, White Jesus, Black Problems. He's also shared the stage with artists like Taj Mahal and Lyrics Born. Now the Grammy-nominated musician from Berkeley has his own project. His album is called A Universal Love Language. James Sticknasty Small spoke with KALW's Janae Darden.
James Sticknasty Small, welcome.
Thank you.
So you've been playing drums for a long time, since you were a baby.
2 years old.
2 years old from Berkeley. Of course, I have to ask, where did the stage name Sticknasty come from?
That name has been with me since middle school. My uncle, he gave me that name. I remember it clear as day. We were standing in the kitchen. My uncle's like, "Man, you're so sick with it. You're Sticknasty." And my mom was like, "Stickmaster, I like that." And my uncle's like, "No, Sticknasty." And my mom didn't like it. So obviously I had to keep it.
That is a name my uncle would give. I'm just thinking just that generation. That's Yes, that's something Uncle would do, would call you Stick Nasty. You have a new album, A Universal Love Language. That's what it's called. And I thought it was one of the reasons why I want to talk to you is because drummers don't usually put out albums. And I'm trying to think, I was like, how many albums do I have by a drummer? As a drummer, what does it take to compose an album? You know, what thoughts go into that?
As a drummer creating this album, I definitely needed a lot of help. Of course, I don't sing. So I had all of these ideas, and obviously the rhythm started to come first. And you listen to the album, you'll see there's so many different patterns and rhythms going on. And so I was really just focused on the percussion. Mm-hmm. And then even all of the like synths and keyboards are extremely rhythmic and all over the place. You know, I wanted it to sound like a drum set. I wanted every instrument to sound like a drum set.
And the name Universal Love Language, the title of your album, what inspired that theme, that name?
Well, I came up with the name for the album after all the songs were finished and, you know, realizing that almost all of these are, you know, love songs about, you know, loving yourself and loving others and, you know, your partner. And a universal love language just means there's music there for you when you don't know how to express your love or you don't really have the right words to say. You can use music to express your love for someone and your love for yourself. And you can do it in any language when it comes to music.
Is there a favorite song that you have or a song that, I mean, I'm sure they all mean very much to you, but is there one that's very significant to you?
You are my moon. You know, that's a tough one. Number one, because they're all so different. So it really depends on what mood I'm in, which one really really stands out. But I'll have to say that the last song, My One and Only, is, you know, extremely special to me because it was a song I wrote for my, she was my girlfriend at the time, but now my wife. Wrote that for her birthday a few years ago. And, you know, I never thought it would see the light of day. That was something that was a birthday present for her. And it was supposed to, you know, stay with her. And so to have it out into the world, obviously we changed the lyrics so that it could be universal and anyone could sing it to anyone. But yeah, that song is extremely special to me.
Well, I'm glad that you all shared it with us, shared it with the world. And speaking of you and your wife, you both starred in Fantastic Negrito's visual, I guess it's like a visual album.
Yes.
Or video for his album, White Jesus, Black Problems. And I know you're part of his band as well. And the album White Jesus, Black Problems was inspired by Fantastic Negrito's ancestors from Virginia, his white great-great-great-great-grandmother. I don't know how many greats goes back, but was an indentured servant. And his great-great-great-grandfather, again, I don't know how many greats, you know, was enslaved. So, you know, you have an interracial couple in this, well, I think he said the 1700s. And you played an enslaved man, which is inspired by his, you know, grandfather. And your fiancé played an indentured servant inspired by his grandmother. And that album is deep. It's a great album, and it's deep. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to play someone enslaved?
It was a challenge. It definitely was a challenge. You know, it even though, you know, I was acting and trying to tap into this character and just knowing that it was for a movie, but still feeling the history, the weight of the history, kind of just, you know, trying to pin me down to the ground. It was really difficult. But I knew that the message of the album was extremely important, and it was a lot easier to play this character knowing that I was, you know, doing it alongside my wife, and that really lifted my spirits because it was just a beautiful journey for both of us to go on together. But it was, for my first acting role as an adult, it was extremely difficult.
What were the conversations you all had in regards to race and love in this context of these two characters who are based on real people? Would not have Fantastic Negrito if these two people didn't come together and have a family.
The main conversation was the, you know, main point of the story is just how
these two people against all odds made it work. You know, it's like, doesn't matter, you know, what the people around you, what the rules and what society around you tell you is okay and what's not okay. It's like your love is strong enough, you're going to make it work. And I feel like this role for my wife and I just made us stronger.
That's beautiful, and that's very powerful. Yeah. What is it like performing with him?
You know, every show is different, which is great. We're not just doing the same thing in every single show, because it's almost like musical theater mixed with improv, you know, mixed with jam sessions on stage. So you're never quite sure which direction we're going to go in. So it keeps us on our toes, which I prefer over, you know, playing the same script night after night. So it's a lot of fun and always super powerful. And, you know, he calls his shows Church Without the Religion. And you really feel this energy lifting you up. And it's powerful.
Yeah, I know I've seen you, because I've gone to a number of his shows, and I know I've seen you perform. The musicians are incredible. You all work really hard. So on top of, you know, creating music, you're teaching music. You teach music. You're an after-school teacher. What it is you like about working with youth?
That's just something that's also deeply rooted in me. My mom started an after-school program in Berkeley at Malcolm X. And while I was in elementary school, I would, after school, go over and help her through elementary, middle school, and high school. I would go help her in that after-school program. And then when I went to Berkeley in Boston, I started working at an elementary school out there. Then I moved to Cleveland. I worked in elementary school out there as an assistant kindergarten teacher and after-school teacher. Oh. And then I moved back here, and I've been at Emerson Elementary for, this is my 10th year. And yeah, I'm just have a love for working with kids, and it gives me so much joy.
What is the most important lesson or what wisdom you try to instill in your students?
There's a lot. I just try to lead by example. I think my biggest thing is trying to get these kids to, you know, leave their comfort zone, come out of their shell, so they can really experience life and figure out what they like, what they love, so they can understand that you can be more than one thing. You can wear a lot of different hats. You can love whatever you want. You know, it doesn't just have to be one thing. And, you know, you can have fun while you're doing it.
In this discussion, love has come up so much, and even your album, A Universal Love Language. How do you show love through your artistry, through your community, to the people you love? How do you hope that shows up?
You know that saying, treat people how you want to be treated? That really stuck with me. Like, my parents made sure that was deep in my bones. And so I have just this deep nature of, you know, wanting people to feel comfortable, wanting people to feel safe around me. And yeah, I guess, you know, I don't really know how to explain it other than, you know, leading by example and making sure that I am pouring out the love that I want to receive.
That was drummer James Sticknasty Small speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. James's album is A Universal Love Language, and he's performing at 111 Mina Gallery in San Francisco this Friday. Janae's interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Monday was Yom Kippur, marking the end of a 10-day period that consists of the holiest days in Judaism. So today, we're bringing you a story about how one scholar worked to make a seminal Jewish text more accessible to English readers. Daniel Matt spent 2 decades translating the Zohar. In this story from 2016, Judy Silber tells us about the text and its significance.
Beresh Hermanuta de Malka, Galif Gilufe Bitihiru Ila'a, Botsina de Cardinuta Nafik, Gostim de Stimu, Miraza de Ensof.
This is the Zohar.
Kutra Bagulma, Naitz Bizka, Lachivar, Vlaukam, Lasumak.
Written during the 13th century, its contents are the bedrock of a Jewish mystical tradition called Kabbalah.
Aved Gavnin La'anhara.
The Aramaic language here is being read by Berkeley scholar Daniel Matt. He spent almost two decades translating the Zohar and writing commentary to explain it. That's a long time, but the Zohar is a massive book. When complete, the new work will total 12 volumes, each hundreds of pages long. Matt is responsible for most of that. For centuries, the Zohar's mystical teachings held a central place in mainstream Judaism. It was a guidebook to a closer relationship with the divine, for connecting to something larger than our small human selves.
Beka v'la beka avira dilei, la'ichida klal, ademigo d'chiku d'v'ki'ute.
The Zohar is central to the Hasidic branch of ultra-Orthodox Judaism. Madonna also brought fame to the Kabbalah Center in Los Angeles. But for the most part, the Zohar's teachings are unknown. In part, it just dropped out of style. But also, for a long time, there was no good English translation. Basically, if you wanted to study Zohar, you had to know Aramaic. Jesus spoke Aramaic. What if no one had translated him?
Bereshit, in the beginning. At the head of potency of the king, he engraved engravings in luster on high.
This is Rabbi Aubrey Glazer. He's an early adopter of Daniel Matt's new translation, and already he's brought it to the attention of his synagogue, Congregation Beth Shalom in San Francisco.
From the head of infinity, a cluster of vapor forming in formlessness, thrust in a ring.
Every Saturday, Glazer holds Zohar study sessions. Each week, he reads a passage from Matt's translation, which has been released volume by volume since 2004. He tells congregants not to try and understand everything, but to listen and let whatever images come up.
As a chord surveyed, it yielded radiant colors deep within the spark, gushed a flow.
The Zohar is a provocative book. And Glazer says, really, for the first time, the translation makes its ideas accessible to an English-speaking audience.
How people imagine the Big Bang occurred, right? What was it like at that moment, just before the millisecond, before creation and the world came into being?
Not white, not black, not red, not green, no color at all.
Its answers are often less literal than visceral.
It split and did not split its aura, was not known to all until under the impact of a splitting, a single concealed supernal point shone.
Maybe you can hear. The Zohar is highly enigmatic. Glazer says it's like jazz. Maybe you don't know where you're going, but you can get lost in ethereal worlds that grab hold of imagination and heart. And some of its ideas are pretty radical. How is God described? Forget that old man in the sky. The Kabbalist God includes male and female parts. The Zohar also describes God as being beyond gender, as infinite, boundless.
As to why it's reemerging now, it's a great question. And to me, it seems like it's part of the zeitgeist. The Jewish world has been moving in the direction of, and perhaps more oscillating, between an embrace and a repression of the mystical.
In the 19th century, Jews began to reject the Zohar's teachings as superstition. But then in the 1960s and 70s, Buddhism and Hinduism arrived in the West, bringing spirituality more into vogue. Separately, scholarship on the Zohar also appeared. Jews realized they had their own rich mystical tradition to draw on.
It's something that now is reemerging with great force and bravado, and thanks in no small part to the remarkable, remarkable work of Danny Matt.
I had been working on Zohar for many years. I had actually translated selections of it many years ago.
Daniel Matt says he had no intention of doing the full translation. He fell in love with the Zohar as a young man in college. He wrote a few books about it. And back in the early 1980s, as a young professor at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, he finished translating what he says was about 2%.
And ever since then, people said to me, well, when are you going to do the other 98%? And I would say, well, I don't want to spend the rest of my life translating the Zohar.
Then a friend, a famous Zohar scholar, called in 1995. He said a rich Chicago family, the Pritzkers, who owned the Hyatt Hotels, wanted to fund a full translation. Matt's first impulse was to say no. He thought, it would just be too hard.
Beresh hermenuta de malka, glif gilufe betihiru ila'a.
That was an excerpt from Judy Silber's story from 2016. You can find the whole piece at klw.org/crosscurrents. And since it aired, the Stanford University Press published a complete translation of the Zohar in 2018. Today's Cross Currents team includes Pat McMahon, Molly Blair Salier, James Rollins, Gonadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.